I rented that house for 3 years. It was my home, but that didn't matter to the landlord. One late rent payment, and suddenly, I was out on the street. No warning, no chance to fix it. Just a cold, impersonal notice taped to the door. 30 days to pack up my life and find somewhere else to go. At first, I was pissed. Fuming, actually. How could he just throw me out like that? No one should get evicted over something so small. I had to do something to make him pay, and make him regret treating me like trash. That's when the idea hit me. My dog, Cooper, had been by my side through thick and thin. Every morning, I'd walk him through the neighborhood, and every morning, without fail, he'd leave a little gift behind on someone's lawn. But this time, I decided his gift wasn't going to waste. I waited until late, well after midnight, when the neighborhood was dead silent. I snuck into the basement, the part of the house I knew the landlord never checked. The unfinished, musty-smelling space was the perfect canvas for my plan. I had gloves, a bucket, and Cooper's contributions from the last week, smearing it on the walls, thick and sloppy. I could feel the satisfaction rising in me. The walls were coated in layers of filth, a silent, disgusting secret that only I knew about. Once I was done, I painted over it with the same beige color that had been there when I moved in. No one would know, at least not right away. By the time I finished, the room was a sealed tomb of stink and rot. I chuckled to myself. It was petty, sure, but it felt good to leave something behind for the landlord to discover, slowly. I imagined his face weeks later when the smell started to seep through the paint. I could almost hear his cursing already. When I left the house for good, there was no final inspection. I dropped the keys in the mailbox and drove away. Weeks passed, then months. I heard nothing. No phone call, no angry voicemail demanding answers about the basement. Maybe he hadn't noticed yet. Perhaps he was too proud to reach out. But I knew that stench was there, waiting to bloom like a toxic flower. I moved into a new place and started fresh, but part of me was still waiting for the fallout. One day, as I was walking Cooper, I noticed something strange. It was subtle at first, but I felt that someone was watching me, just the faintest prickle on the back of my neck. I shook it off as paranoia, but it happened again, and again. The first real sign was the note I found tucked under my windshield wiper. No words, just a crude, childlike drawing of a house with something smeared all over it. I crumpled it up, figuring it was some weird joke. But as the days went on, little things started happening. Small scratches on my door, like something was scraping against it in the middle of the night. Sometimes I'd hear faint knocking, barely noticeable, just loud enough to make me get up and check, only to find nothing. One night, as I was drifting off to sleep, I heard something that made my blood run cold, the unmistakable sound of paint scraping. At first, I thought it was coming from outside, but when I got up to investigate, I realized it was inside the house. It was coming from the walls. I stood there, frozen in my hallway, listening. It was a slow, deliberate scraping, as if someone or something was clawing at the layers of paint. My breath caught in my throat as I turned toward the living room wall. There was nothing there, no marks, no scratches, but the sound kept going. The next morning, I tried to convince myself I was imagining it. Stress, guilt, whatever. I told myself it was nothing. But the scratches kept getting worse. Louder. Closer. I noticed a smell too, faint at first, but familiar. That sour, putrid stench. The same one from the basement. I couldn't take it anymore. I called the landlord, trying to play it cool, hoping to gauge if he had found my little gift. He answered on the first ring. "You thought you could hide it, didn't you?" His voice was calm, too calm. "What are you talking about?" I tried to keep my voice steady, but my pulse was racing. "That little surprise you left for me, the basement. You think I didn't notice?" I swallowed hard, my mouth dry. What do you want?
Oh, nothing, he said, almost playfully. Just thought I'd return the favor. The line went dead. That night, the smell in my house grew stronger. No matter how many windows I opened, it clung to the air, thick and oppressive. I could barely breathe. The scratching was constant now, like something was trying to claw its way out of the walls. And then, just as I was about to leave, to get the hell out of that house, I saw it. A slimy brown substance, thick and glistening, oozed from the crack. It dripped down the wall in slow, deliberate lines. At first, I thought it was some kind of paint, maybe mold, but the stench was undeniable. The smell was the same one I had left in the basement, the same one I had sealed behind layers of paint. It wasn't just the smell, though. The ooze was moving and pulsing like something alive, pushing its way through the wall. I watched in horror as a shape began to emerge. A small, twisted form, like fingers clawing their way out, wet and rotten. I backed away, my heart pounding in my chest. The ooze spread, creeping toward me, leaving a trail of decay in its wake. I could hear it now, the faint whisper of something breathing inside the walls. Something alive. I left that night and never went back. But wherever I go, the smell follows me. It clings to my clothes, my skin, my dog. And every now and then, I hear that faint, familiar scratching.
Would appreciate if you could hit the like button before moving on to the next story.
In October, my husband Dan admitted that he had lost most of our savings through online gambling. This came as a huge shock. For one thing, I had no idea that Dan was interested in gambling at all. He'd never even mentioned it before. More importantly, though, I trusted him more than anyone. As soon as he told me, I could barely look him in the eyes anymore. I could tell he felt guilty, but it was going to be a long time before I could even consider forgiving him. He enrolled in Gamblers Anonymous, and I had to take on a second job just so that we could get the bills paid on time. I was hired as a temporary worker at Target, just for the holiday season. The gig started a few days before Black Friday, and I was genuinely nervous. I knew how crazy Black Friday was. It was the one day of the year when people acted like absolute animals just to save money on presents. After my first day, my new coworker, Debbie, pulled me aside and assured me that Black Friday wouldn't be as bad as I thought. I guess she could tell that I was nervous. She explained that the shopping stampedes only happened in large urban areas, not small towns like ours. She also said that all of the craziest customers had already been banned from the store. Well, Debbie had been working at the same Target for over a decade, so I trusted her. On the morning of Black Friday, I clocked in at 7 in the morning. I was right on time, but all my coworkers were already there, organizing displays and psyching themselves up for the hard day ahead. By 7:15, there was already a huge line outside our doors. I could see the crowd through our windows, and I instantly got nervous again. Debbie walked over and told me to take a deep breath. I think we're done setting up the front. Why don't you go take out the trash before things get too crazy? And if you see anything out there, remember to bring it back inside. I think she was doing me a favor. She wanted me to go outside for a bit and clear my head. So I went to the back of the store and grabbed the bags filled with all the autumn-themed displays that we had to throw out. The dumpsters were right next to our back door, so it wouldn't take me long. But when I got outside, two heavy bags in my arms, a woman was waiting for me. Hey, she said, you Debbie's friend? Yeah, I said. Great, let me in. She explained that she and Debbie were sisters. Every Black Friday, Debbie helped her sneak in early so she could get first dibs on all the best deals. Now, my first instinct was to tell her no. I didn't want to lose my job on my first week. But then I thought about Debbie. She was my only work friend so far, and I didn't want to lose that. She'd sent me out here for a reason. She clearly trusted me enough to help out her sister. Plus, if they'd been doing this for years, then it wasn't that big a deal, right? So I eventually gave in and let her inside. Still had to throw out the bags of trash, though. As I was tossing them in the dumpster, the door slammed shut behind me. The woman had locked me out. I didn't have my keys with me, so I pounded on the door, demanding that she let me back inside. Through the small window on the door, I could see the woman look directly at me and flip me off, and then she was gone. I knew I was in big trouble. Maybe that woman didn't know Debbie at all. I still had a key to the front doors, but I couldn't go that way because the mob of people would shove their way through. My only choice was to call Debbie and ask her to open the door for me. She answered on the first ring. "Debbie," I said, trying not to sound panicked, "I got locked out." "Oh," she said. She paused for a long moment before asking, "You didn't let anyone inside, did you?" I had to tell her the truth. I told her about her sister and how she locked me outside. "Oh God, no!" she screamed into the phone. "She's not my sister!" I waited for Debbie to explain who this was, because she clearly knew the woman. But then I heard a loud bang, and Debbie didn't say anything else. I stood there in stunned silence until the back door reopened and the woman came back out. "All done," she said. "Thanks." She casually walked past me and disappeared around the corner. She left the door open, though, so I went back inside. I heard a bunch of shouting voices, but I couldn't figure out what had happened until I saw Debbie bleeding on the ground. She had been shot in the stomach.
"Why did you let her in?"
she moaned. Those were her dying words. After that, a policeman came to ask me some questions. He took me into the staff room, where he waited for me to stop crying. I told him everything. He pointed to a row of pictures on the wall, all the faces of past customers who were banned from the store. "Do you recognize any of these people?" he asked. And sure enough, I saw the woman's face looking down at me from the wall. Under her photo was a description written in marker. "Extremely dangerous. Multiple employees have a restraining order against her. Call the police immediately if you see her." "That's her," I said. "The policeman told me not to leave town." My boss walked in, wiping tears from her eyes, and said I should leave the store immediately. Our location was closed for the rest of the day, the first time they had ever missed Black Friday. I can't tell you how guilty I feel. I was so desperate not to make any mistakes at my new job, and now because of that, I'd accidentally let my friend get murdered. Now my husband's gambling mistakes don't seem so bad. The clock on my dashboard blinked 11:37 p.m. The only light guiding my way was the narrow beam from my headlights, slicing through the darkness like a knife through velvet. The road was deserted, stretching out like a black ribbon under the sliver of a moon that seemed to be hiding behind the trees, almost as if it didn't want to witness what lay ahead. I hadn't passed another vehicle in half an hour, and the thought of the next town being almost 30 miles away weighed heavily on my mind. It had been a long day. A meeting in the city, followed by hours of driving through the back roads. I was drained, but the emptiness of the road had become unnervingly monotonous, keeping me on edge. Just when I began to contemplate whether stopping for the night might be a safer bet, I saw her. She was standing by the side of the road, a faint outline barely visible in the darkness, long before my headlights reached her. It was strange. I couldn't shake the feeling that I had seen her before, even though that seemed impossible. As I got closer, I could make out that she was wearing what looked like a sari, its fabric fluttering in the slight breeze. The image was strikingly out of place in the middle of nowhere. I instinctively slowed down, something deep inside me urging me to stop, even though I usually ignored hitchhikers. My rational mind screamed at me to keep driving, to ignore this bizarre sight and push on. But the sense of isolation, the sheer loneliness of the road made me hesitate. What if she needed help?
What if something had happened to her? I pulled over to the side of the road, the gravel crunching beneath the tires. She turned to face the car, and as my headlights fully illuminated her, I felt my breath catch in my throat. Her face was pale, almost ghostly, with deep, dark eyes that seemed to bore into me. She looked young, no older than her mid-20s, but there was something timeless about her, something ancient that I couldn't quite put my finger on. "Do you need a ride?" I asked, trying to keep my voice steady as I rolled down the window. She didn't reply immediately. Instead, she stared at me, her eyes reflecting the faint light from the dashboard. Then, without a word, she walked around the car and opened the passenger door. The scent of jasmine filled the air as she slid into the seat beside me, her movements graceful, yet oddly mechanical. "Where are you headed?" I asked, trying to break the silence that suddenly felt oppressive.
"Just drive," she whispered, her voice soft, almost melodic.
It sent a shiver down my spine, but I pushed the feeling aside. There was something compelling about her presence, something that drew me in despite the unease gnawing at my gut. I did as she asked, pulling back onto the road, the hum of the engine filling the space between us. The night seemed to grow darker, the trees on either side of the road closing in, their branches like skeletal hands reaching out to us. My mind was racing, trying to piece together what was happening, but every time I tried to focus on a logical explanation, I'd found myself glancing at her instead. She was staring straight ahead, her hands resting in her lap, the sari's fabric shimmering in the dim light. I couldn't help but notice how beautiful she was, in a haunting sort of way. There was an air of sadness about her, a melancholy that seemed to seep into the air around us. I wanted to ask her more, to understand what had brought her to this desolate road in the dead of night, but something held me back. It was as if I knew that asking would open a door that could never be closed. I drove in silence for what felt like an eternity, the tension between us growing thicker with every mile. The road ahead was still empty, no sign of civilization in sight. I stole another glance at her, noticing the way the moonlight caught in her dark hair, how her skin seemed to almost glow in the darkness. That's when I noticed something strange, her reflection in the rearview mirror, or rather, the lack of it. The passenger seat was empty in the mirror, as if she wasn't really there. A cold sweat broke out across my forehead, my hands gripping the steering wheel so tightly that my knuckles turned white. My heart began to race, pounding so hard I could hear it in my ears.
"What's wrong?" she asked, her voice cutting through the panic rising in my chest.
I couldn't answer. My mouth had gone dry, and my mind was spinning with a mix of fear and disbelief. I wanted to slam on the brakes, to throw her out of the car and get the hell out of there, but I was paralyzed. Something was holding me in place, some invisible force that kept me from reacting the way I knew I should. She turned to look at me, and for the first time, her expression changed. There was a hint of a smile on her lips, a smile that didn't reach her eyes.
"You're wondering why you can't see me in the mirror, aren't you?" she asked, her tone almost playful.
I nodded, the fear choking me, making it impossible to speak.
"You're not the first one to pick me up, you know," she continued, her voice now laced with a chilling calmness. "And you won't be the last."
Suddenly, it all made sense. The familiarity, the sense of déjà vu that had nagged at me the moment I saw her. I had heard stories, urban legends about a ghostly figure who haunted these back roads, luring unsuspecting drivers to their doom. But those were just stories, tales told to scare kids around campfires. They couldn't be real. Could they? My pulse quickened as my eyes darted back to the road, desperately seeking any sign of escape, but the darkness seemed to stretch on forever. There was no turning back. The realization hit me like a cold wave. I was trapped, just like the others before me. She leaned closer, her breath cold against my skin, sending shivers down my spine. "Do you know what happens to those who pick me up?" she whispered, her voice barely audible over the roaring in my ears. I didn't answer, but the terror in my eyes must have given me away. "They never make it to the next town," she said, almost sadly. "They become a part of the road, just like me." In that moment, I saw it. Flashes of my own future. A twisted vision of endless driving on an endless road, never reaching my destination, never escaping the nightmare. I was doomed to relive this night over and over, just as she had. And then, without warning, she was gone. The seat beside me was empty, the scent of jasmine lingering in the air. My heart was pounding so hard I thought it might explode, my breath coming in short, ragged gasps. I slammed on the brakes, the car skidding to a halt in the middle of the road. I sat there, frozen, trying to process what had just happened. My mind raced, my body trembling uncontrollably. It took all my strength to turn the key, shutting off the engine, plunging the car into silence. The darkness outside was impenetrable. The road ahead, nothing but a void. I don't know how long I sat there, paralyzed by fear, but eventually I forced myself to start the car again. I needed to get out of there, to put as much distance between me and that cursed road as possible. I drove without looking back, my eyes glued to the road ahead, my heart heavy with the knowledge of what I had just escaped. But as the lights of the next town finally came into view, a new fear gripped me. What if she wasn't the only one? As I pulled into the gas station on the edge of town, I glanced in the rearview mirror one last time. For a moment, just a fleeting second, I thought I saw her standing in the distance, her eyes locked onto mine, her smile chillingly familiar. I blinked, and she was gone. But the scent of jasmine lingered in the air, a reminder that no matter how far I drove, I would never truly escape.
XXXXX1004.
I could not believe my luck. How often did one get a serial killer in their neighborhood? One with a Netflix documentary special on them, spanning episodes. The number rolled across the screen, blurred in some parts, but I could still make out the figures from the pixelated picture. I was bored. It'd be a fun game to play with whoever was on the other end of the phone. Serial killer or joker, as I expected. I had no idea what was coming from the other end of the phone call as I placed my cell phone to my ears with a grin on my face, but I sure did not expect the exhibition of a Netflix horror special in my house just because I dialed a number for the fun of it. The clip still played on my TV. Of course, horror was only the figment of a very fertile mind. And after a third can of beer, I was sure I did not possess such clarity to conjure something fantastic. I chuckled when a plump, red-haired lady appeared on the screen and started to speak with tears in her eyes. Netflix, I snickered. They were all paid actors feigning emotions for views. The number connected, and the phone rang once, and then went silent. I reclined into my couch and basked in the silence. The scene on the screen cut back from the woman to a reenactment of the horrible view with a man towering over another man, axe in hand, and hacking into the victim as though he were a piece of wood. I smirked in disbelief.
"Hello?"
A gruff voice called my attention away from the television.
"What? Are you real?"
The first words that escaped my mouth were a meaningless babble.
Who the fuck are you?
He asked. I sat upright when I sensed his tone turn serious.
It's not important. Are you Jesse Bjorn? I asked.
He fell silent for a while. A while that spanned an eternity. An eternity in which I was staring at the screen with my breath turning shallow as I paled. I am Jesse Bjorn, he said. And suddenly the line went off. The silence in the room deepened. And suddenly I caught myself in wonder as to why I had called the man and invited such danger into my life. I reached for my Netflix remote across the table and turned the volume higher to drown what I sensed was an incoming wave of anxiety. The man on the screen now was a police officer, and he spoke in a subdued tone, almost reverently for this killer who had a Netflix documentary. Jesse Bjorn was a man as callous as he was powerful. He had a lust for blood that could not be contained, and he could not be confined to an institution because he had been declared clinically insane when he had been caught. He was compulsive, and he would go after whatever he set his eyes on without stop. He had been arrested and had been freed on that occasion because of his good behavior, even though some officers feared that he may have put up a charade. I checked the date on the production of the documentary, and my jaw dropped. It was the same year. I gasped. Suddenly, my phone rang. It was strange that my phone would ring at the time, and when I picked it up, I did so with deliberate slowness. I looked at the number on the screen, and it was a number I was unfamiliar with. I had the better thought to dismiss it, but I gave in. Hello? I breathed into the phone tensely. Max? The caller called my name. Yes, I replied. My phone beeped a couple times and the line disconnected. My heart skipped a beat. I searched mentally through the many people who would call my phone with a number I had not saved on my device, and it did not stick immediately. Then it struck, like lightning flashing through gray clouds of confusion, offering violent clarity. I drew my attention from the timbre in his voice. He had spoken to me only once, but the personality behind the call and the force of his inflection was undeniably that of a man who had some menace behind his words. For the umpteenth time that day, my jaw dropped again, and my beating heart swept into a frenzied thump. I could scarcely make out what was happening on the TV anymore as pure fear crept in. The words of the cops came to my ears, and I slowly began to realize how much danger I was in. It was not a fixation that I was ready for, but I did not have the time to process it clearly because it was barely 10 minutes before I heard a vehicle screech to a stop outside my house. I jumped from my couch immediately and ran straight to the kitchen. I went through the cabinet in a blitz and fetched a knife and cleaver. I pulled over to the wall and remained as quiet as I could in anticipation. Large, powerful hands banged on my door. The kitchen walls around me began to spin. The image of this absolutely insane being whacking a man to death with an axe stuck in my head. My head clouded quickly and a fizz clogged my ears. Raw steel breaking through wood snapped me out of my reverie. My heart went straight to my mouth. I imagined how furious he was, a man with a lust to kill, and he had found me in 30 minutes. Damn, I muttered, realizing I should have called the cops. My door creaked, and the light into my apartment immediately went off. My heart sank. I slipped out of hiding in the darkness, realizing I could not sit like a duck and do nothing while waiting on death. My thumping heart blurred my vision, and as I started to walk back to the living room, I feared for everything that moved. The house went silent, and my heart pounded when I saw the specter of this mountain of a man materialize right in front of me. The light filtering into the house from outside gave him a ghoulish appearance, and for a moment I felt my spirit leap out of my body. I could not afford yelling.
You wanna play games?
No, I confessed, stuttering. I saw your Netflix special today.
And you called death because I'm going to kill you now, he roared.
Please, I begged. I don't want to die. There was no time to explain. He whacked, and his axe cut across my face, missing me by a few inches. The heft of his blade packed enough wind for me to realize how fatal that blow would have been. I was no match for him, so I dropped to the floor as though I'd been caught. Ah! I cried in the darkness, and he growled as he rushed to my side. He took aim blindly when he assumed he was by my side. I jumped to my feet, and with my heart in my mouth, I stabbed the knife I held into his neck and twisted in the frenzy. Blood spurted out of his neck, and he collapsed onto his knees. My light came back on when his body hit the ground, and I quickly moved away from the horrible sight back to the living room where my TV had come back on, and the Netflix signature beat dropped. I started to think of what to do with the dead attacker in my corridor as the horror of his face popped up on my screen.